It is New Zealand Music Month, and that is a little bit of a recent single by one Luca George, L-U-C-E-A, Luca George. Luca George is a self-described songwriter, a beautiful singer, photographer, snappy dresser, and a horticulturalist. His debut single, Lonely Tonight, dropped, as they say, on the 16th of April. And I don't know about you, Deverita Johnson, but what a tune.
Oh, my God.
Bring back the tunes.
Yeah. It reminds me of, like, that kind of longing restlessness of being in a different country.
It's the best song I've heard in the last week.
It's like Lost in Translation, but the musical version, that's how what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, let's have a bit more. Here we go. Tonight, I need somebody to kill this time. Pretty cool, eh?
Yeah.
Stephen, what do you think? Are you there, Stephen?
Yeah.
You're just speechless, gobsmacked. No words.
I'm helpless in the face of any question about relative merits of music. I'm a musical pig. I like most of it, but without much discrimination.
Well, because around the panel, I'm a music fan. Are you a music fan, Verity?
I think so.
Yes. You
think? Quite niche.
Stephen,
yes.
Do you go after a hard day's office work in the office? And law and put on a CD or a record?
No,
or?
I just flick a Spotify playlist and let it run with whatever happens. But for me, the ideal would be a mix, that an algorithm that put together.
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay.
Oh, it's no. Just background for me.
Okay, fair enough. Yep. There you go. Anyway, that's Luca George, very recent and a very new talent in Aotearoa. I hope Luca does well there. It is 25-5, the panel RNZ National. Public servants earning more than $60,000 will only be offered pay increases under exceptional circumstances for the next 3 years. Senior leaders and those on more than $100,000 have had their pay frozen entirely. The government wants pay increases to be targeted to lower paid public servants, those earning below $60,000, who make up around 25% of the public sector. Finance Minister Grant Robinson said, quoting, "Our priority are the people who earn less than $60,000. They are, relatively speaking, in the public sector, low paid. Bear in mind, if you're under 60K, you're still around the average overall. And we think that is the correct focus in a restrained environment." With us to discuss is PSA National Secretary Erin Palachuk. Erin, kia ora.
Wallace, how are you?
Very well. Nice to have you on the program. And so this affects everybody from, you know, ministries to DHBs. You got the police, you got lab workers, dock rangers, and so on. What do you make of this announcement?
Oh, look, we've responded with our members' disappointment, and all day today we've been hearing from our members, and I guess I could describe the mood as angry. A lot of the comments coming our way are about how unacceptable and disrespectful this feels, especially after the year we've had, where public servants have worked just so hard to keep COVID from circulating in our communities and actually make sure things like the wages subsidy got into the pockets of people who lost work. You
know? And I have heard that sort of sentiment, particularly, say, for example, lab workers. What sort of message do you think that sends on behalf of the government to say salary rises will be frozen for the next, few years?
It makes the gratitude that's been expressed feel hollow. You know, on the one hand, to say we really appreciate the work of the public service in keeping New Zealand safe and keeping us actually to the most trusted and least corrupt country in the world. And then yet on the other hand, we won't pay you any more or they're signalling that they don't even want to have that, a proper good faith bargaining round with us this year. It's just not fair.
But on the other hand, targeting toward lower pay public servants, those earning below 60K, Erin, who make up around a quarter of the public sector, that's fair enough though, right?
Oh, we absolutely want the lowest of our membership, and most of our members, by the way, the median's around 59,000, so they are just slipping into that lowest paid. Most PSA members are kind of in that 60 to 70,000 bracket. Of course we want them to get paid more highly, but we don't think that people in that 60 to 100 should expect nothing, especially in the year that they've had. And I know you've been talking about house prices, but yep. Public servants often work in and live in Wellington and in Auckland and in places where, you know, getting a place to live is difficult, and the cost of living is unaffordable.
Let's go to Verity first.
I'm just curious. You mentioned that the median price, salary you're talking about for your members is around $59,000. So is that the lab workers we're talking about? Because that, I'd be really interested in knowing if there were some professions like lab workers who have been working overtime in the last year who would actually be, you know, sort of around, who would be lower than 60, and if they would still be getting salaries, or are they caught in that 60 to 100 freeze?
I wish I had those figures in front of me, but I can tell you that there are groups at the borders that people would be surprised about, like quarantine officers, customs officers and so on, that are getting paid under that $60,000 mark. But it's not high-paid work in the public service. I think this is something that people often get surprised about.
You've got a customs officer at $59K a year, biosecurity $63,000, quarantine $70,000, and immigration officers $53,000.
Well, all of those are not going to necessarily be affected, are they? I mean, I'm a little bit surprised. I think that we're kind of accepting this as the spin in this. On Boxing Day, there was a report that said public servant salaries had risen at 13% over the last year. Now, that wasn't individual salaries. I think that was the total cost. But it referenced the fact that there's now more than 1,250 who get over $200,000 a year, and that the average salary is $84,000. So by targeting this at those at the upper end, they're probably just reimposing a bit of discipline that most people in the country had imposed on themselves a long time ago. And it also says that where there's serious recruitment pressure in the area, then it won't apply. So that's just what you'd expect any employer to do, respond if you have to pay more to meet the market. I don't think that this looks like it's an announcement to try and parry criticism ahead of the budget on the fact that they've actually allowed public service incomes to blow right out, and employment.
I think more people are being employed by the public service because now more than ever we know the value of the work that they do, and so that will make it look like there's more being paid. But our members haven't been seeing big pay increases, especially not since COVID. And I think everybody's accepting the, you know, we do what we can for the public of this country. That's what public servants do. But to be told for the next 3 years you're effectively having a pay cut is just not fair. And it's spoke to a member today who was, you know, recalling not that long ago working 6 hours a week and 13 hours a day, and he's a manager. You know, what does he say to his team to keep them buoyed in the next week? You know, people are feeling already quite worn out, and this is just a slap in the face for them.
It might be some people are going to pay the price for lack of discipline in other areas. I mean, the amounts that it expressly says that those on the lower levels, the 60,000 and below, are not affected by it. So if it's an in-between, they can respond to market forces. So there's quite a lot of flexibility. I don't actually see it as a serious statement.
Well, Aaron, actually, because it's technically a guidance, isn't it? I mean, it's not an edict, right? You can still offer an increase.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you bargain a collective agreement, it's between a union and an employer. So we see it as kind of the government's, proposal for their bargaining position, if you like. And it's certainly not something that our members are going to accept. But I just want to pick up on some of the positives that are in there, actually, because there are a few. And one is the recognition of the need to address inequities in the public service. We still have a gender pay gap. We have an ethnic gender pay gap, and we have an ethnic pay gap. And I think, as the panellist already mentioned, we've got issues between the lowest paid and the highest paid. You know, that's the gap between them is too wide. There are definitely areas that we will be progressing on behalf of our members, even with this pay restraint language.
All right. What are your final thoughts, Verity?
I really hope that the 1,200 civil servants who are making over $120,000 a year, I hope that they're the ones who actually are affected by this, as opposed to the people who have been working, yeah, like we said, on the borders and customs and quarantine. Yeah.
It's over 200,000. It's not 120.
All right. Well, Aaron, nice to have you on the program to discuss the issue.
Thanks very much.
Erin Palutchuk there, the PSA National Secretary, and quite a response to that, actually. Kind of split in the middle on how you feel about it. But I just want to read a bit more feedback. Well, here's one. Naomi says, I'm a public servant, member of the PSA. My view is the whole country has taken a huge public hit. Public servants in general have had rare job security, and the higher paid government workers really can't complain about not getting a pay rise. We are fine where we are, and targeting limited government funds at the needier groups is how it should be. Managers do need to communicate that we are lucky to have the jobs we have. That is the truth overall, is, excuse me, Naomi's view. And William, here's one for you. Hey, go live somewhere else and get a job. If you can't afford to live in Auckland, don't. We live and work in Tauranga and walk for this for you, Verity, and walk 400 metres to the beach. We're not rich, and we work hard to get a deposit on our very first house in Auckland not that long ago on the baked beans and sardines diet. It's always been a struggle to get a house deposit throughout our history. Most working class parents came to New Zealand in 1952 with a 9-week-old baby and not much else. I'm fed up with the moaning and carrying on about house prices. It's always been tough. We are still hanging on to this stupid, perpetuated myth by banks and governments that anyone should be able to own a home.
Yes, but the ratio of housing affordability wasn't 1 to 6.8, which is the historic high for the last 17 years in New Zealand. Absolutely. So when you bought a house, it probably wasn't at 6.8 affordability. And I'm not saying you didn't work hard, but I also think the people who are from Tamaki Waikato were born here. It is our town. You should be able to live in your town. It's your place. You shouldn't be kicked out.
Stephen, responds to that?
I wouldn't convert it to a right. I mean, there's, but I certainly think that it's quite different to have a struggle getting a house at a ratio of 3 times the average salary or 4 times the average salary and up to 10 as it is now in Auckland and Wellington.
Okay. And one here, or just a couple more before we go to our next guest. I'm a tradie and I bust my bleep doing weekends overtime and on call for $55,000 a year. $60,000 to me is a lot of money. Another one, my partner and I bought our first home, an Ockham apartment in Auckland 3 years ago after both only ever living in a standalone Auckland home. It is so dry, warm and cheap to run, low maintenance, secure and has an amazing community. We live 5 minutes walk from Avondale College, village rather, and the train. It would be hard to go back to a standalone house.
I agree with that. I love living in an apartment and I genuinely think they are the way of the future. I don't think that the New Zealand psyche around shame and house ownership and how if you haven't bought a proper house by the time you're like 35 has shifted. Though, so I think you can say yes, buy an apartment, but I think a lot of people still have a dream of a house, and I just think that it's just like you're taking a really sacred part of New Zealand psyche and saying, oh, you can't have it, sorry.
What's an Ockham apartment? Is that some term that I should have learned?
No, it's just a brand.
It's a brand.
It's like Lockwood.
It's by a developer.
Yeah,
okay. Is it Mark Ockham who?
Yeah, they've got a funky little logo.
Yeah. To a remote dairy in Northern now, where you will find, where you will not find any cigarettes, alcohol, even any vaping products. Highlighted in a wonderful piece of stuff reported today, Te Wanganui Dairy in Tauturu has been open for 7 years and has never stocked these products. Dairy owner Sarah Martini is with me now. Sarah, kia ora.
Kia ora Wallace, how are you?
Good, it's lovely to have you on the program and a wonderful story. Tell me about the dairy here. Why did you make the decision, and this is over 7 years, not to stock cigarettes, alcohol and other products such as?
Well, ultimately it was because I didn't want my kids to be smoking. And I didn't want my mokos to be smoking. And it was also partly because I didn't want to be a target for robbers or anything like that. So a lot of that came into it, but so did our community. So we were, we still do Zumba and, we have some health programs running at our marae, and a big part of that push was about being smoke-free. So our marae's are all smoke-free. They're all alcohol-free as well. So it's more about promoting it for our tamariki and our mokos.
Yeah, and because Sarah, this has been a really big issue, hasn't it, amongst other dairies, and there's this very small but actually growing movement for non-cigarette dairies specifically, but was it hard for you to actually open this dairy in Tauturu and actually say, you know what, from day one, I'm not going to sell cigarettes, because you must have people coming in and asking for cigarettes?
We do, we do. And it was hard to start up, you know, 7 years ago. And it's always been a work in progress. And we do have people, you know, weekly coming in and saying, oh, do you sell cigarettes? And no, I say to them, well, no, sorry, bro, we don't. And I'm sorry to say we never will, but we have wonderful pies here. I'll get your ear off for the next 5 minutes while you're spending money.
Yeah. I might do a little shameless little plug for you, Sarah, because I've been reading about some of the locally made pies that you do stock, such as Muttonbird and Kumara. Pretty big sellers.
Yes, definitely. Oh, well, Muttonbird, Kumara and Puha pies. My baby actually makes them, and they are huge sellers. So, and Muttonbird is quite hard to get. So, yes, when we do have Muttonbird in, they're out the door just as quickly as they come in.
I really want to try one now. What is it? What does Muttonbird taste like? I've never had it.
Oh, I mean, just talking to you, I'm salivating.
Yeah, I'm getting a bit dribbly too. Yeah.
You have a question?
So it's really, it is an acquired taste, but it has a beautiful, rich, salty, smoky taste to it. So with some fresh puha, some beautiful toboi, which is the flat, you know, like a takako almost, I suppose, and boiled with some kumara to add that sweetness. It gives you a bit of, it gives you a bit of everything, actually, a bit of sweet, a bit of sour. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Wonderful. We have a panellist here, Sarah, and Stephen's also with us. Stephen, you got a question or a thought?
Yeah, I think the kumara and muttonbird pie sounds fantastic. They're, as you say, an acquired taste, but I don't think it's that hard to acquire it.
I agree.
And I think a pie would be the best way to do it. You need to disguise it first off.
But, yeah.
I was interested that you vape yourself, and I think that I really admire the principle you started with, but I think that's quite self-denying not to be able to supply yourself from your own shop.
So, well, it is a bit, is that in regards to the cigarettes?
Yeah, or the vaping.
Yeah, you know, I personally believe, because I've been a smoker on and off over the years, and I've looked at vaping, I've tried vaping, and the very first vape that I purchased in Kerikeri, they gave me a little tube with it. And in that little container was, the first thing I saw was a skull with the crossbones on it. I thought, well, that can't be very healthy either. So even vaping, when I was a kid, I started, when I was five, when I was at Totoro school, we all, as children, we all lit up the smoke in the bush sort of thing. It was actually portrayed as something that was really quite cool when we were kids.
Right, yeah. Sarah, I'm just going to ask you, in terms of the smoke-free dairy, because it sounds like you're more, Te Wānga Nui Dairy is more than just a dairy, it's really a big focus of the community. Would you support and endorse other dairies to try and give it a go? Because the common refrain we do hear is that we can't stop selling cigarettes because we cannot afford to do it.
I would support people that don't want to keep selling, because a lot of our business is about customer service. You know, that's how I feel anyway. So, you build a rapport with your customers as they come through. And yes, they may only come through. I'm in a very rural area, and we're quite remote, and I depend on a lot of tourism that come through the summer. But in saying that, they come through every summer. So I've gotten to know quite a few of the tourists that have come over, some that have come from down south, and you do build a rapport with them, and I think it's not the cigarettes. They've got to come in for drinks, they've got to come in for food. If they've got children, they've got to come in to make sure that their kids are things. So it doesn't really matter where they are, they're going to stop. And I think if you make their visit memorable, then they would more likely detour to your store than to anybody else's.
Okay. And before we go, Sarah, so now into the future, cigarettes, big no-no.
Definitely a big no-no. Right. Definitely a big no-no. I support the Cancer Foundation and their petition to, not have any more in any of these places. any more dairies that open up, because it isn't a necessity, as far as I'm concerned anyway.
Great to have you on, Sarah, and all the best for Te Wānanga Dairy in Tautora there.
Thank you, and if you're ever in the area, please come and try our mutton bird puha. Oh.
I'm coming. I cannot wait.
Don't you worry. We'll be there. thank you, Sarah. All right, 7 to 5, the panel, NZ National. A group of Queen Street landlords and businesses have been taking legal action to stop further work to make Auckland's main commercial street more pedestrian-friendly. The Save Queen Street Society is seeking a judicial review of Auckland Council's decision-making around a pilot program to test pedestrian upgrades, reports RNZ. And in the High Court at Auckland today, the Save Queen Street Society lawyer Sam Lowry said the group did not oppose the goal of making the street better for pedestrians, but the ongoing pilot program was harming business in an already tough year. And he's earlier said that the street is a mess. It looked like a construction site, foot traffic has declined, and storefronts, they're empty. With us to discuss this ongoing issue is editor of Greater Auckland, the website and blog, Matt Lowry. Kia ora, Matt.
Kia ora, Wallace.
This is becoming quite the stoush over the Golden Mile, and I think I read on one of your pieces, actually very recently, you're really frustrated on both sides with this issue.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's most frustrating about this is that every time that we have these debates about streets in Auckland and everywhere else as well, when they finally happen, everyone finds that the outcomes were actually... they're actually quite positive and big uptake. So, High Street, Fort Street, all these places in Auckland where we've upgraded them, and there was a lot of pushback from retailers at the time, and we've upgraded them and their takings increase as a result of it. And so there's no reason to think it won't happen again. The big elephant in the room, of course, is that, yes, pedestrian numbers are down. That's because we haven't allowed tourists into the country, overseas tourists and students and what have you into the city centre, so people aren't visiting. And one of the figures that we know is about 30 to 40% of business in the city centre comes from people not living in Auckland.
Ah, right. Well, we're a bit short of time, so we'll just jump straight into our panel, Verity. You obviously know Queen Street here.
I do. I would agree. It's like, it's interesting that you say there's been uptake in High Street post pedestrianisation, because at the moment I haven't been to Queen Street in about a year because it just does my head in, because it's just such a mess. And
well,
I can't.
There you go.
Yeah, I just don't go. But I also feel as though Auckland's going through one of those incredibly uncomfortable stages where we're trying to pedestrianise, increase public transport, but the taking away of car parks and that kind of thing has happened faster than the catch up for the public transport and the increases has happened in response. So I feel like we're in a really awkward stage where the City Link is coming and the pedestrianisation is coming, but at the moment all the car parks have already been taken away, although like it's hard to get an announcement taken away, so people are in that weird squeeze.
We're in a grey phase, Matt?
Yeah.
I think there was pre-COVID, there was a lot of signs that was changing. We had actually a big reduction in the number of cars that were entering the city centre and a big increase in public transport, walking and cycling. So that was actually happening and coming through. And while it was harder for some people, it was easier for others. And so, that change is happening. That COVID has sort of knocked it on its head. It's changed travel patterns. It's changed how people want to travel and when they travel. So that has been a big impact. And that's probably really the story here. It's not about the changes. And while some people, all these disagreements about the appeal of them, the moaning about them has probably helped put more people off than the actual changes themselves.
Well, Stephen, these issues are playing out in the CBD in Wellington as well. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's easy to... overlook a factor that no one wants to talk about because it's so hard and no one knows what to do. But it's a little like the public transport patronage. If for me, walking down Queen Street is something I avoid because I find it so depressing to see the homeless and the signs of my society, which it just doesn't know how to respond to a whole lot of people who really aren't coping. And some of them look so desperate and out of it. It's actually a far bigger turnoff for me than anything else. And so I would say that it's similar. There's a similar risk coming for Wellington in Courtney Place, that when it starts to feel threatening or just unpleasant. People will find a number of reasons, and one of them might be access. But I think the real reason is that it's no longer a nice place to be.
A quick response to that, Matt.
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of things that put people off coming to the city centre. I mean, whether homelessness is there or not, but it's something we can solve. I mean, we solved it during lockdowns. We should be doing more to solve that as a wider issue, you know, but that doesn't affect necessarily that whether we roll out improvements to Queen Street or not.
If it becomes more pedestrian, it seems to me it's even more likely to be a good camping place for people.
Well, there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of that, Stephen, to think that. Oh, we'll run out of time. Hey, Matt Lowry, thank you very much for that. Matt from the Greater Auckland Transport blog there, and Verity Johnson and Stephen Franks, thank you very much for being with me today on the panel. I'm Wallace Chapman, back tomorrow 3:45. Till then.